Accession number 9889, Reel 1.
You're going to ask me some...
Mrs. Seccombe, Reel 1. Can you tell me about your family background, where you were living and where you were brought up?
My family background? Oh, well, I lived in Devon as a child, but we moved to Brockenhurst, Hampshire, in about 1937, I think.
Did you go to school?
At Southland School, Exmouth, and I went to finishing school in Switzerland, which nobody has nowadays, but we went there to learn French. And that's what we did.
And what did you do after that?
Nothing. Just lived at home. Frightfully boring. Nobody ever did anything in those days. just amused myself. Had a horse that kept me occupied. No, it was really awfully dull looking back on it.
Did you have any ideas for a career?
No, never dreamt of it. Absolutely not. Never crossed my mind to have a career. In fact, I think we all looked down on girls that did do something because they couldn't do it. I mean, getting married was the thing we wanted to do.
What about an interest in flying? Were you interested in aeroplanes?
Yes, well, I always wanted to fly. My first flight was when I was about 12, and I expended my life savings of 5 shillings on a trip with Sir Alan Cobham at Alan Cobham's Air Circus. He used to go around and do things in fields. This was near Exmouth, and I liked that and always wanted to. And so when the Civil Air Guard started in about 1938, I think I joined that. I didn't get in it till 1939, and then I did just have a little bit of tuition, and I had 3 hours solo, and for that you got your pilot's license. That was all you needed, 3 hours solo and one or two simple tests, as I remember.
What sort of an aeroplane was it?
Oh, Gypsy Moth.
And what were the instructors like in the Civil Air Guard?
Oh, well, it was a flying club. You see, you did it at a flying club. So they were just ordinary instructors. I mean, they weren't Civil Air Guard instructors. The flying clubs got a subsidy. They paid for you until you got an A licence, and then they got £50 or some fabulous sum. And so it was in their interest to push you through as soon as possible. And I really didn't know anything, but I just thought I did, thought I wanted to fly. And so when the war started, the Civil Air Guard was disbanded. And then an ATA was started, and I wanted to join that. But then you had to have had at least 500 hours and be very experienced. But as the war went by, they took people with less and less experience, or none. And the fact that I just had this little amount got me in.
Did you write to ATA when the war broke out?
Yes. And they turned me down. And then I got married, and so I didn't try again until my husband was in submarines, till he was drowned. And then I had a baby, in that order. And it wasn't until she was 18 months or two that my mother thought she could manage her. I then started trying to get into ATA again.
So
and after a bit, they took me.
So during the early stages of the war, you were looking after your child?
Yes. Well, you know, you weren't... you couldn't get any help, practically. Eventually, we got some 15-year-old or something, and that was... My mother did it, anyway. But, see, everybody got called up after about all the young girls and anyone, unless you had a baby.
Did you feel you wanted to do some
more? Oh, Lord, yes. Oh, yes, everybody wanted to, at least as far as I knew. dying to, and especially when I was a widow, I was longing to do something because, you know, you wanted to get your teeth into something, not just hang about being dismal.
Were there any facilities for mothers with young children in your circumstances?
Oh, no. What do you mean, facilities? No.
To look after the children while you worked?
Never heard of any. I believe factories had nurseries or something, but I never heard of anything. Anyway, it's difficult to leave a young baby, even if you had a very good nanny.
So how did you come to apply to the ATA again?
Oh, well, then, as I say, my mother thought she could manage, and so I thought of various things I would like to join or do. I nearly joined the Wrens, and then I found that ATA would take me. So I joined that instead.
How did you actually come to join? Did you write to them again?
Yes, I wrote to them. And then I went for an interview and a flight test and that sort of thing. And Pauline Garr, it was running it. And to my astonishment, they said they'd have me.
How nervous were you? Because you hadn't flown for some years.
Oh, well, I was terrified most of the time, really, I suppose. Oh, well, they taught me absolutely from scratch. And there were a number of others. We went to Tame Airfield near Haddenham, and you started really right from the beginning, and it was just like a flying club. We went off every day to Barton in the Clay near Luton, and it had been a flying club, and it really felt just like one. We were taught only instead of having to pay for it, we were paid to do it. It was very enjoyable, and then you gradually worked your way up and started ferrying things.
How long did the actual training last?
Well, it went on all the time, in a way, because they divided the planes up. You've heard all this. Other people have told you.
How about your initial
class
training?
Yes, that was
initial.
Oh, well, there was a little bit of ground school, sort of navigation, those sort of things. And then you had a period. First of all, it was Magisters. And then you had a period going off on cross countries, all around the countryside, to sort of learn your way about. And then it was Harts and Hinds we had. They soon died out. They were sort of a first war plane, I believe. And we had a bit of duel on them. And one or two other things. And then you had a time as a Class 1 pilot, mostly being the taxi pilot in a Fairchild Argus, which held four people and was used for going around picking people up and putting down again.
By the time you became a Class 1 pilot, how confident did you feel in the
air? Oh, I was quite confident in that sort of thing. Fairchild. It wasn't quite like driving a car, but it got to be almost that you got into it quite happily and flew away. But later, when it was Class 2, which was all the fighters, it was often quite alarming. Because although you were taught how to fly anything, so you didn't have any duel. You had to read it in a little instruction book. And your first going a strange type, you all wanted to do it, but even so, I must say, my hand used to shake. I used to have one hand shaking on the stick and one hand shaking reading the instructions of the other. No, I wasn't frightened all the time, but I was frightened a lot of the time.
With your intake of ab initio pilots, did anybody not make it through?
Oh, yes, heaps didn't. I don't know what happened to them, they just disappeared. They failed in you had tests at different times. And I don't know why they failed, but some of them failed, and so they disappeared from view. No, there were quite a lot didn't. But I think most people did. Or they weeded you out very quickly right in the beginning, as I remember. If you hadn't soloed after so many hours, about 10 or something, you disappeared. You didn't get any uniform or anything until you'd done that, so they didn't waste anything on you.
Whereabouts was the training pool?
Well, it was Tame Airfield, Haddenham, now Aylesbury. And we were there for quite a time, and then they sent you off, seconded you to somewhere else for a month, and then back to the school again, and that sort of thing, until they thought you were getting on a bit.
And were they just women pilots being taken?
Oh no, mostly men. I should think 5 to 1 men it was. I should think 4 or 5 to 1, mostly men. But some of them were frightfully stupid and couldn't manage the navigation and that sort of thing, couldn't read a map or elsewhere, undisciplined and always turning up late or not turning up at all, that sort of thing. Well, they got the sack quite quickly.
Were the men and women treated any differently by the instructors?
No, I don't think so. I know, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure the women didn't get a if they made passes at the instructor, they didn't get on a bit better. I think something, I think a certain amount went on, that sort of thing.
How about the other men that you were working with? How did they treat you, react to you?
Oh, perfectly normal. I mean,
was there ever any feeling that women shouldn't be doing that?
No, I don't
job?
Think so. I don't think so. Women were doing all sorts of things then. No, it was great fun. We all enjoyed it. It was a very jolly lot. It was a good deal of pairing off, I seem to remember. A certain amount going on, as you can imagine. But, no, basically, we were all treated alike. I don't remember any.
Did you live in billets?
Yeah, either billets or at Tame. There was a house for women only, and the men had sort of huts, some listen huts, which were for men only. It was very uncomfortable, I do seem to remember. Very squashed in a small room with uncomfortable beds, but I mean, one accepted all that.
Were you able to have leave to get back to
school? Oh, yes. Yes. At the school, you had a day off a week, I think. And after that, I got myself based at Hamble. I specially asked to be. Well, then my daughter was at Brockenhurst, so I used to go home two or three times a week, or something.
How sympathetic were the ATA to you wanting to be near your daughter in that way?
I think that was all right. Compassionate posting I applied for, got it. Some people had wives and families, and they managed to get near them, you see. No, I think that was thought to be quite reasonable.
Did you go straight to Hamble from Tame?
Yes. Except that I had a month here and a month. I went to Cosford for a month and somewhere else, I think. That was my first sort of proper permanent posting.
Tell me what Hamble was like.
Oh, well, that was great fun. It was all girls and very nice lot. And it was a very happy pool, I'd say. I don't remember any backbiting or jealousy or whatever goes on in women's organisations. No, it was great fun. And I made some nice friends. We had a very jolly time.
What did you think of the commanding officer?
Oh, she was great. We all liked her very much. I think it was entirely due to her. She kept us happy because she was a good leader, I suppose. We were all... So say when we had a 40-year reunion, we were all very pleased to see each other again. It was great fun.
Did you have any particular rules or regulations?
Nothing like the services. Nothing special, only common sense. I mean, you were expected to be punctual, and we were all so keen, that was the thing, you see, there was never any question. You wore a uniform, but we liked that. It was very useful. You were always right wherever you went, you see. If you went up to London, went to a nightclub, and dinner at the Savoy and that sort of thing, you were always dressed in the right way if you were in uniform. So it just made life very easy.
What was the attitude towards the wearing of trousers?
I think everybody wore trousers. We were wearing trousers pre-war. I think that was not, taken quite for granted. Women had been wearing trousers for quite a long time.
How adequate was the clothing for flying in?
Oh, perfectly. I forget. Oh, well, we had these jackets and outer garments most of the planes were closed in, you see, and they weren't cold, well, not very.
But you had sometimes to fly an open
plane. Yes, well, then we had what we have, Sidcut suits, great padded things, you looked like a Michelin man. That kept you pretty warm. Of course, we were all young, who didn't mind those sort of things.
So can you give me some idea what a sort of a typical day's ferrying would be from Hamble?
Oh, well, I should have looked in my logbook. We got a lot of Spitfires, more than anything else, and you might have a We would start in the Anson, be dropped somewhere, and take a Spitfire from somewhere to somewhere. Probably only 20 minutes flying, but a lot of sort of fiddling about on the ground. And then you might wait there, and somebody in a Fairchild might pick you up, take you somewhere else, and then you might get something different from here to there. And you might have perhaps 3 flights in the day, and a lot of waiting around, and a lot of being a passenger in the taxi thing. But no, you got a mixed lot. You went from one thing to another. I mean, that was part of the fun and the challenge, really. And the long trips were much in demand. We always wanted to. I did once go to the Isle of Man, and I hadn't realised, actually. I don't know, I ought to tell you this. This is another stupid story. I was quite confident by then, and I'd known the way to. You went up to Blackpool and turned left or something, and I hadn't bothered to work a course out. I hadn't realised that it was quite so far out, Isle of Man, and that you would be going over the sea out of sight of land. And it was a sort of a hazy day. I set off, went up merrily to the coast and set off at an angle I thought was about right, just having done it in my head, my eye. And the Isle of Man, it was one of those hazy days with no horizon, very calm but hazy and cloudy. And the Isle of Man didn't seem to appear. And I went on and on, and of course it went off my map. I remember trying to think, now, I suppose I'll hit Northern Ireland, will I? Or will I, or is the Isle of Man, is there a gap there? And will I go straight out into the Atlantic? And I was getting more and more worried. When searching round, I saw a shadow of an island sort of behind me to the right. And so I hurriedly dashed over to it and was very glad to see it. And that was entirely overconfidence and carelessness. So I was lucky not to go straight out. Well, I would have reached Northern Ireland, of course, wouldn't I? From the Isle of Man, if I'd just gone west.
Did they give you any particular training about flying over water?
No, well, we didn't really. No, I mean, I don't remember that. We were supposed to work courses out, but you see, we soon got to know your way about and didn't bother after a time.
How did you get on with the idea of map reading and finding?
Oh, that's easy, yes. I was good at that. If you can read a map, you can. I mean, we started by ruling lines, working out angles and that sort of thing, but you get to know Britain and recognise, as soon as you've done it once, you'll recognise it the next time. And it was always rather a point of honour if you were flying another ATA pilot. Not to look at your map. I thought it was quite uncanny when I remember starting, and the senior ones were just taking off and flying somewhere and not looking at their map. But I was soon doing it myself, because when you've done it once or twice, England's quite small, and you recognise everything, you go the same sort of way.
Did it worry you at all that you were out of touch with the ground? You didn't have instruments?
No, it never occurred to me. I liked it in a way, actually, because it was, you were out of the war. The war was going on. There was a lot of heartbreak and anxiety, and somehow when you were up there, quite cut off, I liked that. It refreshed me, as it were.
Were you worried at all?
What, being cut off?
Just by flying up in the air?
No, I liked being up in the air. But I mean, I got lost sometimes, and landing. I mean, suddenly I was always very tense, thinking all the things you've learned. You had to do all your sort of checks, and suddenly my hand shook as a rule for a bit after I'd landed.
What were the chief hazards you had to face?
Well, I suppose bad weather or engine failure, or else your own stupidity, I suppose. I just think that as much as anything.
Did you ever have any problems?
What, with stupidity or bad weather? Well, no, I got into clouds and things once or twice, and you weren't taught how to fly blind, and so one was sort of, you got out of them and in and out and lower and lower to get underneath them, but anxious to get to your destination rather than turn back, because perhaps there was something you wanted to do that evening or something, you know, so one was inclined to press on for the wrong reason. No, I was often frightened, I think.
What about the aircraft themselves? Did you ever have any problems with the engines?
No, I didn't. One or two people did. I expect you've chatted them up already. No. Oh, well, once when I was a passenger, chap was it was one of these little Fairchilds, and there was suddenly a large, a lot of noise, and the cowling slipped forward and got entangled in the propeller, which flew off, and so in pieces. However, he landed in the field quite successfully, very neatly. But I was only a passenger.
Did you have to fly aircraft that were not entirely airworthy?
Oh no, I think they were airworthy, but there were sometimes ones that were marked only one landing or something like that.
How did you feel about flying those?
Oh, I took it quite for granted. I had absolute confidence in what I was. I never thought about anything like that. No, just my own. No, I'm sure everything. I had complete confidence in the ground engineers and so forth.
Did you ever have any accidents?
No. I don't think so. Except once taxiing. That was entirely stupidity when I completely ruined some poor little plane. I was taxiing about much too fast without looking where I was going. And I ran it over a nasty spike which was sticking out of the ground and split this poor little Fairchild from top to bottom, at least all along its tummy. However, I got away with it by telling frightful lies about how it had been covered with snow. And I was at Cosford, and the CEO there, she was very kind about it, because I think I had a perfectly good safety record, you see, really. And anyway, she sort of rather endorsed my story that there was snow about, and it was the RAF airfield, and I was exonerated from blame, and the RAF was blamed for not having kept their airfield clear. But it wasn't there, it was my fault, really.
Did you have to go before a committee?
No, I just had to write in a report and waited anxiously until I got the reply. It wasn't my fault at all. I was completely blameless.
Were you all right?
Oh, yes. No, it was just, on the ground. But, not popular. Some people were always doing that sort of thing. Some of the men, you were much more careless. I think girls were more careful and didn't show off either. Men were always shooting up their girlfriends or something. Girls were less likely to do that. And I expect a lot of them were nervous, and so you perhaps took more care over what you'd been taught.
Did you ever do any of these things, like low flying or aerobatics?
Oh, no, I never did aerobatics solo. We weren't taught to. I often had them done to me by some nasty instructor that wanted to frighten you. Yes, I do think sometimes they wanted to frighten you. No, I never quite fancied trying on my own. One or two girls did, but who were braver than me. We weren't taught, but they found out from their boyfriends how to do it. And went off and had a try, but no, I never fancied turning upside down, actually.
Were you allowed to do it?
No. But, low flying, now that was fun. I did sometimes low fly, because you really get the feeling of speed then. But now people, where we go to Scotland, sometimes fighters come by over our heads, and they're an absolute curse. I do remember, though, what fun it was.
What was the official attitude to low flying?
Oh, very dangerous. Certainly I weren't allowed to do it. Only with instructor. Sometimes part of the training was a bit of low flying. There were low flying areas, and very often your instructor liked it too.
Were you given any instruction on false landings?
Oh, yes. You practiced them a lot in the school. Just touched down and then opened up again. Instructors, they were always making you do that. They'd suddenly cut the engine without telling you when, you see, and so then you had to get into a field. But no, I think one had quite a lot of. The training, of course, was very good.
Did you stay a Class 1 pilot, or did you convert
Yes, no, I went on to Class 2 and spent most of the winter. Well, that was big class, you see. It was all the fighters, which there were a lot. And then Class 3, which was the easy twins. That was as far as I got. Then the war ended, just when I was due for Class 4. There wasn't much school in the winter because the weather was bad, so it rather depended when you'd converted, when you'd gone one up. You probably spent the winter with... You see, you just added, when you did the classes, you just added that to... I mean, when you... Class 3, I would do an Oxford or an Anson or something, and then do a Spitfire, and then I might still get a Tiger Moth or something on the same day.
Did you have particular types of aircraft that you either liked or disliked?
Yes, well, everybody likes Spitfires. They still, that's, I mean, there's a bit of glamour attached to a Spitfire. I can still... people are interested. Everyone's heard of Spitfires. When I say I've flown Spitfires, still means something. But, no, we were very lucky to get all that experience. It was a wonderful job if you're keen on flying. And I say we are popular girls, very much in demand. And
how were you treated by the ground crew when you landed at various
aircraft? Very well. Yes, we often spent the night in an RAF mess, and we were very often the centre of attention because girls were still fairly much of a novelty. And no, it was great fun.
What sort of status did you have as an ATA pilot?
Oh, well, you were treated as an officer. Of course, we weren't commissioned officers. I mean, it was civilians, but you were allowed to use officers' messes and go to officers' clubs and all that sort of thing. You were treated. You were sort of an honorary officer, I think.
How adequate were the facilities for women at the airports, aerodromes that you landed at?
Well, usually there were there was a WEF quarters where you could spend the night. Or once somebody, one of the CEO took me back to his house for the night, or else you went off to a pub somewhere.
Was there ever any animosity towards ATA pilots, either by other women or by the men?
I don't think much. I don't think so, hardly at all. I think the WEFs were rather envious. I think they were a bit annoyed because they thought they ought to have been doing it. And some of them did manage to join it just to the end, but then it was all over then. No, I think that was fairly irritating for them, have these girls stumping in and being very pleased themselves.
Was there ever any chauvinism on the part of the men about you flying these airplanes?
I do remember once, a very nasty little... it was my first Barracuda, and so I was feeling nervous. And when I got to it, it was at Worthydown, because I was nervous, I had to wait, it wasn't ready. But I suppose I started talking... you know, you can relieve your feelings if you talk to somebody. And I remarked to the chap in flying control that it was my first Barracuda. And instead of getting any sympathy or encouragement, which is what I wanted, and being told, you know, they're perfectly simple and great fun, I'm sure he was a failed pilot. That was why he was doing flying control himself. He got frightfully annoyed about it and started ringing up people and saying, in my hearing, to say, there's some girl being sent here to take one of our Barracudas. She's never flown one before. You know, what shall he do about it? It's perfectly disgraceful, that sort of thing, which made me even more nervous. However, he was told it was all right and I was to do it, but it didn't help me. And in the end, I went away leaving logbooks behind, so he was even more pleased, I'm quite sure. But he really, yes, that was male chauvinism, you might call. He was annoyed.